So my name is Fairuz Ben-Youssef. I'm a philanthropy advisor with my own practice, Fairuz Ben-Youssef Consulting. I help nonprofits who are looking to leverage their capacity in terms of management issues and particularly major gift fundraising. I've been doing this literally since I left college, so, you know, only a few years. And I, too, have many stories like these ladies in terms of how they turned their passion into a true business, and we'll share some of those today with you. What we're essentially going to do is treat this pretty much like a conversation, and so we're going to Oprah style it, as I like to say, ask questions, and then towards the end, after we go some of the questions that we have discussed together, if there's time, we'll allow for some of the audience to also ask some questions, if that's okay with you. All right? Are you ready? All right. Here we go. Well, let me introduce one of our panelists here. Mm-hmm. So, Lila Igram. Everybody wave Lila.
Hello.
So, she has put together a bootstrapping volunteer team that together donated over $50,000 of in-kind services to launch Connect Her, a global communication and crowdfunding platform that's focused on advancing women and girls globally. Connect Her provides a diverse communication platform, including the Girls Impact the World Film Festival, to spotlight critical issues facing women and girls throughout the world, and a robust user-friendly process for understanding and matching donors to high-impact partner projects. Prior to that, Igram worked for Flow, a nonprofit which advocates conscious capitalism. During her time at Flow, she worked in the area of community outreach, and she grew up in a very entrepreneurial family that led her to co-founding her first company in 2004, a t-shirt company that actually advocated for social justice. She just hasn't tirelessly stopped since then, I tell you. Lila was born and grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and graduated from the University of Iowa. And she has traveled extensively in the Middle East, South America, Africa, Europe, has lived in Cairo, Egypt for 1 year, and is a treat for us to have here today with us. We also have with us the amazing Ritu Sharma, who is the co-founder and president of Women Thrive Worldwide, an author, Teach a Woman to Fish, and I'm so excited that we will be able to together have a great conversation with you. And I look forward to having each of them tell you a little bit more about their own stories. If you're coming in, please come on in. There's more seats in the front of the room. Just remember to please silence your cell phones. Okay, so here's what we're going to do today. I think what everybody probably wants to know, and sorry for the folks over here because you won't be able to see me, is there somebody that might be able to help us move this podium back a little bit? Noelle, you might be able to help us have someone. Oh, she's so sweet. She's volunteering up here. Okay, we'll get this moved over so y'all over here don't feel like you can't see us.
Should we just do it real quick, all of us?
I'm not sure if we can. I don't want anybody to get hurt. Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay, so Ritu, let's start with you. When I do this work in the nonprofit field, especially around raising capacity, which is something you each would have had to do as you started your gigs, one of the most important things is the story. Mm-hmm. So I'd love for you to start and then for Lila to just, what's your story? How did this come to be? Tell us a little bit.
Sure. Happy to. Okay, first I have to say those are the most fabulous shoes I've ever seen. You know, aren't they gorgeous?
So, I mean,
we all know women dress for women. We don't dress for men because we want to, you know.
Totally. So, thank you.
So my story in brief is that my parents are from India, from Punjab, from northern India, and I was born in Canada and raised in the United States. And both of my parents, my mother and father, come from family backgrounds where there was a lot of violence. My mother's mother, my grandmother, was burned alive for a dowry death. Her in-laws didn't feel that the dowry was sufficient, and my mom witnessed that happening. And my dad's mother died in childbirth with him. She was 15 when she was married and had a baby every single year. Until my dad, who was the sixth child, and so she was only 21 or 22 when she had her sixth child, and she died in childbirth. So, you know, I grew up really thanking God every single day that I was raised in the United States and not in India and didn't have to deal with those challenges. And I think as a result, always wanted to do something. to give back. So, you know, my parents, God bless them, they're Indian parents. They wanted me to be an engineer or a doctor. And so I tried to split the difference. So I said, okay, I'll major in economics. Okay, is that? And so they allowed that, but I had a subversive mission. I majored in international development economics and not in finance, which is, I think, what they were hoping. But I really wanted to find a way to really help women in India and elsewhere that were just by luck of birth, you know, were going to live really, really difficult lives with a lot of challenges and a lot of violence. So I came out of school, and I went to school in Washington, D.C., and I'm someone that I hate politics. I really disdain politics, like probably a lot of you. But I got my first job walking around Capitol Hill and being basically a lobbyist for international environmental issues, and then became a lobbyist on international basic education, which basically was trying to convince our government to give resources to educate girls and boys overseas in very poor countries. And in that time of walking around Capitol Hill, I really fell in love with little p politics, not big p politics, because it became clear that if you had passion and good ideas, you really could make a difference. You could go into the office of a member of Congress and talk to the staff, who, by the way, are all under 25, so they were all my age at that time, and say, you know, let's do something good for kids around the world, and you could really make it happen. I could talk all day long about how things have changed in Washington, but so I sort of fell in love with doing that. And the other thing, though, that became clear is that there was really no one in Washington representing the voices of women and girls in developing countries. There's about a billion women and girls that live on less than $2 a day, and their voice wasn't really being heard. The only thing that was being talked about was women's reproductive health, so between the hip and the belly button, that was all that got attention. There was nothing on violence or women's economic opportunity or voice or women in politics overseas. So a group of other women lobbyists in Washington and I came together, and we decided to start this small group that would have as its mission every day to go to the White House or to Congress or to the U.S. Trade Representative's office and really represent the needs and the views of women and girls around the world. So we thought we were filling a small niche. It turned out that we were really filling a huge gap, and we grew very quickly to a budget of nothing to about a budget of $2.5 million. And it's been 17 years now, and we've gotten some amazing things done and continue to do so. So I'm actually transitioning out of the organization as its founder after 17 years, so looking forward to the next adventure. But that's my story.
That's huge. Thank you. Lila.
Lila.
So our organization, Connector, is we launched our website in 2011, so we're just a few years old, so it's a little different scenario, but it's been also really fantastic. And I think just through the whole process of starting Connector and creating the partnerships that we've created, I've really gotten to know myself a lot more. And what that means is when I was a stay-at-home mom for several years, I graduated from college, and then I really wanted to stay at home with my kids. We have three amazing kids, and they're all older now, two in college and one in high school. But throughout the process of kind of being a stay-at-home mom and raising my kids, I always wanted to just, you know, change the world. I read every single issue of Fast Company. I stayed up to date on, you know, relevant issues in social entrepreneurship. And I really wanted to have, like, a big, huge impact. I didn't want to settle for just something, you know, small. And so when I started Connector, what I did was, we didn't just focus on one area of the world. We focused on, you know, creating projects and programs that would impact lives in Southeast Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, Latin America. We launched a film festival where we partnered with Harvard students and groups, and we have students submit 3 to 5 minute films on issues related to advancing women and girls all around the world. And it's been hugely successful with tons of impact stories. So, like, throughout this process of just, like, you know, starting something, I knew, like, if I focused on just one area of the world or we focused on one thing, that it would not be lasting. Because I've started things before, and I have the kind of personality where I get really bored easily. So, you know, what we did was we basically, you know, created a platform that would have, you know, a huge amount of impact, hopefully, and that has just been, you know, a great way for us to get started. My background is my mom is an immigrant from Lebanon, and my dad's family immigrated here in the 1930s, and you know, my mom had really sporadic access to education when she was a child. And so, like you know, I mean, I grew up with this background of thinking to myself, well, what if all these girls had access to education? And so, you know, it kind of sparks you to want to do something on the global stage and you know, the tack that we take is that there are already women in the developing world who are brilliant and who are on the ground and doing amazing, brilliant things. So we take kind of an investor approach instead of a kind of victim-savior approach. We don't, you know, we do not take that approach at all. We find people in the developing world who are doing amazing things for education, global health, and we partner with them, and we ask them, what do you need? And then, you know, we work together to create projects and fund those projects that have lasting results for their global communities and local impact.
So, again, amazing. Thank you for sharing, both of you. I think one of the questions, you guys are like so awesome. You want to give them praise. This is great. So one of the questions I think that people would initially want to ask, like maybe in this room you have a burning idea of something that you really want to do. You want to change the world, transform the world, make lives better. It's scary, right, to get out there and take the leap and do it. And so for all the women in this room who may be thinking about that, what nugget of advice might you say or share sort of your own, here's how it happened, and here's what I would now tell you? Talk a little bit to that, maybe. Yeah. Ritu, if you'll start.
Sure. I mean, the first thing that I'll say is that whatever you are passionate about, and whatever that specific thing is that you feel you want to bring into the world needs it. Mm-hmm. So bring it, okay? Don't think, I can't do it, I shouldn't do it, I've got to make money, I've got kids, yada, yada, yada. If there's that urge in you saying do this, listen to it and do it. The second thing that I would say is then take a very business-minded approach to it. Right? It is a passion, but whether you want to do a nonprofit organization or for-profit or some blend in between, it's a business. And you really need to think about it that way. Otherwise, your passion will come out, but if you're not really smart about where to go with it, it will fizzle. And you don't want that to happen. You don't want to get frustrated. So what I would say is learn as much as you can about the area that you're passionate about. So if you want to get into girls' education overseas, go learn about the organizations that are doing that. There are so many organizations in the United States and around the world that are in that area. So whether it's something you want to help, you want to tutor Hispanic kids from low-income families, learn about who's doing that, who's in that space. In essence, this is your marketing research, right? Who's doing that already? Maybe volunteer there. Maybe try to get a job at one of those organizations if that's something that you can do. But you really want to know the space. And that will tell you a couple of important things. One, does your passion really lie there? Because one of two things will happen. You get totally jazzed and turned on, and you're like, this is it. Or you won't. And it's really important to know that before you invest, you know, your money and your time and your energy in something. And the second thing is that you need to know, if you're starting a new business, what's your market niche? You know, what are you going to offer that's different than what's already being offered? How is it better if it is already there? how is your thing going to be better? Because when comes time to really get it off the ground, you have to write those grant proposals. It's just like pitching investors. You have to be clear. Maybe it's not, the return is not a financial return on the investment, but you have to say, this is how many people will be benefited. This is exactly how their lives will be different. This is what you're going to get for your dollar invested in my nonprofit organization. So you need to go about it with that kind of mindset, develop your business model. So I would say, you know, take your passion and hold on to it, and then marry your brains to your passion, and you can't go wrong that way.
That's great. Thank you. Really,
Lila, how about you?
So I would second that, you know, it's just really important to be really focused on the vision and mission, because it's something that you can always come back to. So if you're very passionate about your vision and mission, you have a bad day or you get a rejection or, you know, something difficult happens, a challenge comes up. When you go back to your vision and mission, it's like, oh, yeah, this is why I'm doing this. So if you really believe strongly in something enough, you know, that you'll sacrifice for it, then I think, like, that's a good start. And, you know, I mean, things might not always go the way that you want it to go. For example, like when we first started, what we wanted to do was we wanted to provide markets for products made by women from the developing world, and we're not doing that right now because we kind of shifted course. That was a really kind of difficult way to start out an organization, just because of the sourcing and all of that. So what we did was we decided, well, it's the same kind of concept. We really wanted to help empower people in their own local communities. So what we did instead was we partnered with all of these project partners in all these developing worlds that are creating local impact through investing in these brilliant women local leaders. And so it's the same, you know, kind of concept. And now we're at a point where we have so many project partners that if we do want to get into that area of providing markets for products made by women entrepreneurs, we can do that, you know, much easier now, because a lot of our project partners create products. So I would say, you know, just like really kind of stick to an overall vision and mission and just make it happen however you need to make it happen. And then I would also say, like, you know, find some keywords that you can kind of go back to, like, every day. So, for example, for us and for me, it's lack of fear, innovation, and loyalty. And, you know, I mean, really, you know, whether it's lack of fear or confidence kind of goes back and forth. I have a little 5-year-old nephew, and if you ask him, are you a better football player or is, you know, Ray Lewis a better football player, he'll say, I'm a better football player. Like, anything you ask him, are you a better, you know, nonprofit manager, or is this person a better? I'm better. You know, like, he thinks, and not to say that you should create a false sense of confidence, but really, you have to be ready to do anything at the beginning and everything, and you have to just plunge in and, you know, just kind of make things happen. Mm-hmm. Create the partnerships, you know, cultivate, you know, relationships with so many different people. I mean, you know, with the idea that eventually you're going to have a sustainable organization. Because, I mean, at first, you know, you just kind of jump into everything. But then down the road, I mean, after the first couple of years, it's embarrassing. It's not, you're not proud to say, oh, I'm the only person on staff. You know, you want to create a sustainable organization. So, you know, with that, what you're talking about, like, just kind of having that passion, but marrying it with a logical, you know, business-minded approach is, I think, really, really important. So.
Those are great answers. Thank you. So many ideas going through my head. But I guess in terms of the topic of what we're talking about here, of how to become the social entrepreneur of your life, when you started out, did you think of yourself as a social entrepreneur? What did you venture to be doing?
So when I started, which was in 1997, was really when the Women Thrive was sort of born in concept, there was no such term, social entrepreneur. This was way before, you know, that thing all happened. So I didn't think of myself as, to be honest, I didn't think of myself as anything. You know, it wasn't, I didn't need a label, right? I think this is important for people to hear. You don't need to be anointed as something by anyone to go do your thing, right? Just go do it. And so the good thing about social entrepreneur, having that term, is that there are actually now a world of resources mm-hmm. to help you, grants, you know, tools, mentoring. So there's this kind of this world of social entrepreneurship has grown up, which I do think it makes it a lot easier for those trying to kind of do that new thing. But no, that label didn't exist. And in a way, you know, maybe it was better because, you know, like you said, you have to get out there and just do everything yourself and expect to fail. You know, there are days when you're raising money, for every 10 donors that you cultivate, one will give you a gift. That's 9 no's. And that's normal, right? That's your average response. So, you know, you have to have a pretty thick skin and develop a real passion, a touchstone for what you're trying to do that is more important than people saying no, because there are other people out there who will see it and they'll be like, yes, yes, this is it. This, I agree with you, and I'm going to help you do it. So
I'd add to that that in addition to the 9 that say no, even if it's not their thing,
right.
They will remember. You've made a connection. They'll remember. And when they encounter somebody who it is their thing, they go, oh, I just talked to somebody with, you need to meet her. Yeah, and so that's the power of putting it out there and just bringing it.
Yeah,
I love that term.
Yeah.
How about for you, social entrepreneur?
So, I mean, not really. I didn't really identify myself as a social entrepreneur. I've never liked labels, period. I mean, I just don't like them. I think they're kind of restrictive.
Yeah.
And one of my key things that I said earlier was, you know, lack of fair innovation and loyalty. Innovation is, I think, comes from not, you know, putting boundaries on yourself or labels on yourself. And, I mean, social entrepreneurship is a great word. There's a lot of people doing great things in the world. But, you know, like I did, like I said, read a lot, you know, and read stories about people, whether they were social entrepreneurs or corporate leaders or, you know, leaders in other areas or business people. I used to just read all of these stories and just be so inspired, like, how can I do just even a minuscule amount of, you know, what these people are doing in the world? So, I mean, I don't even have one role model. I probably have a million, you know, like just of, you know, bits and pieces of stories that I've heard and read. So, I mean, social entrepreneurship is a great term. It's a great field. There's lots of, you know, different definitions of what a social entrepreneur is. There's, like you said, vast amounts of resources. There's an organization called the Skoll Foundation. And I think, like, that one of the benefits of just having a term like social entrepreneurship is you can go to the Echoing Green or Skoll Foundation or all of these organizations that pop up to support different people who are in social enterprise and social entrepreneurship. You can see what they're doing. You can, you know, if maybe you don't want to start your own thing, you can join something that someone else is doing. Like, one thing we try to do with Connector is make it really easy for any single person to get plugged in. Because one organization that I worked with prior was purely an advocacy organization. And so it would be kind of a little bit hard for people to get plugged in at different levels. And so what we wanted to do was create a platform where, you know, whether, you know, I mean, just for different people to plug in at very different levels. So
great. So for those who are kind of in the corporate world, and they're thinking about doing something like this on a social level, what skill sets would you say transfer very naturally, and what skill sets maybe don't?
Mm-hmm. Well, just out of curiosity, how many of you are in the corporate world right now?
Lots.
So lots, about half. And how many of you have some little idea that you're thinking, you're sort of starting to scheme about what you think you want to do? So, yeah, so quite a few of you are doing that. So I would say two things about that. One is that some of the skills do translate. Some of the business skills do translate. Sort of business planning, thinking it through, what is the business model for the organization, what is the product line, how is it different, sort of marketing principles. I think those are very, very similar. But, you know, just as a corporate, just as a nonprofit leader wouldn't necessarily say, hey, I have all these nonprofit skills, I'm going to go work in the corporate sector, right? Most corporate people will be like, what? Really? You have to understand that going the other way is the same kind of experience, right? So if you have a lot of experience in the corporate world, that's great. It doesn't all necessarily translate or qualify you to immediately work in the nonprofit world. So I would say if you're interested in crossing over, there's a couple of things that you can do. One is entertain or do a long-term volunteer position. We've worked with long-term volunteers that have helped us with our branding, with our marketing, with our business planning, with our strategic planning, and sort of work with an organization. And by doing that, you will learn a lot about what translates, how is the culture different, how do I adapt to kind of this nonprofit world. And again, you'll also learn if you like it or don't like it, which is really valuable information. The other thing you can do is join boards. A lot of nonprofit organizations really need corporate folks on the board. And keep in mind, it is going to involve fundraising. It probably is going to involve giving money and raising money. Do not be afraid of that. Especially if you want to start a social enterprise, better to get started right now on a board, getting comfortable, asking for money, and learning how to do that than having to cut your teeth doing that when you get to asking for money for yourself, because it's way, way harder to ask for money for yourself and your own thing than it is to ask for somebody else. So, you know, those are two concrete things that I think you can do to begin to test that transition and see if that's something that you want to do.
Awesome. Lila, do you have anything to
add?
Yeah,
I think that, so we have a lot of business people, people in the business world in corporate America, just corporations in general, as advisors. And I think that, yes, I definitely think that skills do transfer over because, you know, a nonprofit is really a business. I mean, you have to be sustainable and you have to, you know, have certain tools to increase your chances of success.
I have to just interject here one thing. I was at a Board Source international conference a number of years ago, and a gentleman who's a British author stood up in his session and he said, by the way, folks, you do understand that nonprofit or not-for-profit is merely an IRS classification.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And the crowd just sort of looked at him and he's like, you know, you can make a profit as a nonprofit. It just doesn't go into the pockets of anyone. It goes back to mission.
Right.
That's the whole point, is we want to fuel a social good mission. And so, to your point,
yes,
we don't have to look like the starving, thriving, or under-thriving, you know, puppy. We want to attract people who will say, wow, they've got some secret sauce there. They're doing the right thing. I want to be a part of that. Because success breeds more success, just as in business.
Absolutely. Yeah. So. No, that's you know, exactly what I was trying to say. And that I think just qualities, people, I mean, also, you know, there's something called entrepreneurship, which is, you know, people inside of big companies who have to, you know, who don't want to be stifled by all of the layers. And so they, you know, what they do is they work within their own corporations to try as hard as they can to be creative. I know it's kind of hard. My husband's been he was at Dell for 10 years, and now he's at Visa, and he, you know, I mean, we talk like daily, just because I want to know everything too about corporate America. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that just having that, you know, there's articles that you can read about it in the Harvard Business Review and Stanford Social Innovation Review. There's a big conversation about nonprofit versus for-profit, or, you know, even within the for-profit world, you know, conscious capitalism and all of these, you know, kind of revolving conversations. But so a lot of traditional people don't understand that a nonprofit has to be, you know, you have to invest in capacity building. You have to build your staff. You have to, you know, build out your programs and invest in infrastructure. And so, like, the Harvard Business Review and Stanford Social Innovation, they get it. Mm-hmm. Like, they're promoting these concepts all the time. So it's a little kind of, it just needs to kind of get more, I think, into the public realm. The conversation needs to get, so donors aren't afraid that they might be paying for someone's salary as opposed to feeding a mouth or, you know, I mean, it's all the same. And you can speak to that.
Yeah,
as well.
So some of you may be familiar with the Overhead Myths letter that came out that GuideStar and the Better Business Bureau's Wise Giving and who was the third one? Was three entities, three kind of the watchdog, charity navigator. They came out last year and they said, hold the presses, people. Here's the truth. You have to invest in infrastructure. You have to invest in paying for the light bill and the staff salaries and the, you know, benefits and professional development. Otherwise, how do you achieve your mission? Mm-hmm. And so it was this aha moment where these entities that represent, you know, kind of the people who watch and hold the nonprofit sector accountable come out and say, wait, you do have to actually spend money to make money, just like you do in a business. Would you ever have a startup business where you say, don't spend any money on marketing?
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it. Because I don't know what our investors would think about that. Doesn't make sense. And so if you look up the overhead myth, it is this awesome tool for any of you who have boards or work with boards or on a board that you can share with your fellow colleagues, as well as this year in 2014, they just came out with a solutions to the overhead myth. Like, well, what would we prescribe or suggest and recommend that nonprofits do knowing this?
So
really great tool.
Business, like, business skills are extremely valuable in nonprofit, just, you know, from my perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's very helpful. So here's a question. Is what you're actually doing now as you look 17 years later, or how many years?
Three.
Is it what you envisioned you'd be doing when you first started out?
Yes and no. I think that in some ways it is and in some ways it isn't. You know, so I think that, I guess I'm a person who's very focused on the now and, you know, what are we trying to achieve for the future, right? Mm-hmm. I don't have a tendency to look back too much. So, I would say yes and no.
A little bit of both?
Yeah.
About you, Lila?
I would say
you alluded to this a little bit.
Yeah,
that
a little bit. Yeah. So we,
you
know, I mean, you're always kind of like shifting and maneuvering, mm-hmm. and you know, I mean, there's always, you know, I mean, I would say probably no, because you know, a lot of times when you start something, you don't really know what is going to happen, and you don't exactly know what path you're going to take. So I think that quote about the, you know, the journey is the most important part, that's really, you know, as long as you're holding tight to your vision and mission, it's the journey that you go on that really is what kind of gives you the satisfaction. So, you know, I mean, you can kind of envision where you want to go, but there's just so many road bumps and so many setbacks and so many challenges and so many changes. And if you're trying to innovate, you always have to, you know, like for us, we're a small nonprofit. We don't have the backing of, like, you know, perpetual grants from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We started the first crowdfunding site focused specifically on women and girls. And then another one started after us that called themselves the first. Not that I'm keeping track or anything like that.
Right, of course.
But,
sure.
You know, they called themselves the first, and they had huge backing from all these organizations.
Yeah. Wow.
And it's like, okay, what can we have to, you know, we have to move fast, you know what I mean? Like, we're always in a sense of urgency because, you know, like, we're trying to keep up with the big guys, you know, and big gals and big whoever, you know. So there's always a sense of urgency. You're always trying to innovate. You know, with the film festival, we have this one amazing sponsor. Her name is Eloise DeGioia. You guys might know her. She's
the wife of the hair dude.
Oh,
John Paul.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But she's just an incredible lady,
amazing.
And she's extremely passionate about film. Mm-hmm. And you know, thanks to her and her executive director Constance, who's here today. You know, I mean, they have been so supportive of the film festival. And I think just like, you know, I mean, making these partnerships, I mean, you don't envision how this stuff is going to happen. So, you know, I mean, like, you just have to keep an open mind and go on the journey and stay focused on your vision.
Well, this is an important key point in terms of foundationally, mm-hmm. when you're getting started, you have to surround yourself with people who are inspired by what you're trying to do, mm-hmm. right? And that have either access to or that personally can support you. Mm-hmm. So maybe on that, speak you first, and then I'd love to hear Ritu mm-hmm. as well. How do you find the resources? How do you even get started? I have a great idea. I'm passionate about it. I've studied up on my marketplace research, but I put some money of my own into it, mm-hmm. but then what?
Yeah. So, I mean, for in-kind services, it's really much easier for me to just knock on doors, you know, like, hey, when we first started our platform, we wanted something mm-hmm. beautiful, you know. We didn't want to throw out a bad product, you know. So I must have contacted 10 different organizations in Austin, at least, who did programming and graphic design before someone finally said, wow, we think that's a, you know, I mean, I must have got rejected definitely over 10 times until someone finally said that we think that's a great idea. We have an intern. It was an organization called Creative Suitcase. I still remember them. They had an intern, and they said, we'll give you 40 hours, you know. And what was the question again?
How do you find people to support
you?
Oh,
yeah.
More than in kind. What do you need to do?
So you have to knock on a lot of doors. You know, you just knock on a lot of doors. But for fundraising, for actually fundraising and asking people money, that's really hard to do. So I like it when people come to us and just say, we love what you're doing.
How do we get that?
Yeah. And it happens. At first you have to bootstrap.
Sure you do.
Right?
Yes,
we had to ask friends and family and, hey, we're trying to do mm-hmm. this, you know. Oh, people are like, oh, that's a great idea. You know, we want to give, you know, we want to support you. So you just have to go out to friends and family. You have to knock on a lot of doors. You have to be persistent, tenacious, mm-hmm. you know. And it all comes back to your vision. For me, it always comes back to the vision and mission. And that's why when I said I found out who I, you know, just know yourself. Yeah. You have to know. You have to know, like, what inspires you. What, for me, on Sunday night, I can't wait until Monday morning.
Okay, this is really pivotal. I had a boss one time say to me, Feyruz, if on Sunday afternoon you start to get that in your stomach, it's time to hang it up and do something else in anything in life. And I'm so glad you just said that, because I think that when, especially you're a young woman or mm-hmm. you're at this next phase of your career and you're thinking, is this all that there is for me? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not feeling great about this. I have had a burning desire to do X. Yeah. It is a huge leap of faith, and it can be super scary. But, you know, the power of what you said, and I'm pretty sure Ritu will speak to this too, mm-hmm. relationships. We all have them, whether it's your immediate or it's your next circle out. Mm-hmm. People give to people. That is a mantra of fundraising all around in philanthropy. We give because we care for others. I mean, think about the word philanthropy means the love of others, the love of humankind. When I said that one time, they're like, well, what about the four-legged? Okay, the love of others, you know. When you give, that's what it's about. It is not about a transaction. It is about, like, I care about you, and you're so inspired. Yeah, the mission is important, but a lot of it is, it's you, mm-hmm. right? So I don't know if you have, do you want to add any more?
I mean, that's true. That's definitely true. You know, I mean, I think when we've had successful fundraising, it's been at events where people see what we're doing, right? So I don't even have to be there, right?
Which recently happened.
Yeah. Okay. So it's like, you know, mm-hmm. people see the work, you know, and they that I think that vision and mission just seeps into everything that you're doing. And so that's what you want to surround yourself with, are people. Like, for me, it doesn't matter if our board members have money or not. It matters that they, obviously the money is nice, you know, I mean, it helps to get the donations, but it really matters that they're so, you know, focused on this overall vision of empowering women and girls in their local communities and telling stories about women and girls that are working to advance, you know, them globally. So that, like, those things, they have to be there.
It's great.
Yeah, I think it is. It is about relationships. I think just starting with the circle that you have and talking to friends and colleagues, and you begin to see who's interested, mm-hmm. you know, who's the bee that's going to, you know, come and take that honey and who's not, and then expanding from there. And, you know, when we started Women Thrive, I think one of the helpful things was that I was already part of a community,
yeah.
right? It was growing out of a movement that I was already part of. And, mm-hmm. and again, that's why I was saying it's real helpful to kind of get into that movement and then start your thing, because you have a ready-made circle of friends and colleagues that already know you.
Yeah,
so.
For sure.
And cultivating these relationships, you don't have to already know what you're doing. You can start like from day one.
Yeah.
Just,
mm-hmm.
you know, like,
here's my idea. This is what I'm thinking.
Yeah. You bet. You will be amazed at the number of people in your network that when you say, and I always share this with my clients and my colleagues and the boards that I serve on, you know, if you want advice, ask for money first. But if you want money and investment, ask for advice first, right? Because think about it. If somebody comes to you that you care for and says, I'd really like to get your advice about something I'm thinking about, and tell me, does it sit well with you or not? Okay, let's say you get inspired by what they're telling you, and then they go off and they do a little bit of work and they come back, okay, we did this, here we are. Would you like to maybe partner with us? You know, we're looking to try to raise this much initially. That's kind of the building blocks of how this works.
You're the total fundraising expert here.
Well, it's just because my quick story is a little girl from Tripoli, Libya, whose parents escaped a very tyrannical, crazy regime and came to get their graduate's degrees here in the States. When I was 8, when my parents were coming to get their PhDs, my dad at 35 was suddenly diagnosed with leukemia. Mm. And there was never a history of any of this in our family, in the Middle East culture. That's like a death sentence. You know, you say saratan, cancer. It's like, what are we going to do? Can't go back to a country where they pluck the young girls and put them in the army to go fight in Chad. Can't go back because there's not any medical care. And so we stayed. My dad went through his treatment. And at 16, I'm diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease.
Oh, my God.
So now I have 2 tumors that need to be removed. I'm 16, y'all. Like, that's not good timing. I just didn't want to hear about it. I was sort of in denial. And plus, everybody in the waiting room that I'd go and be with or in the hospital, I was in the pediatric ward when I had to have my spleen removed because at that time they couldn't tell if the cancer had spread without doing a major surgery. But everybody was either babies or my grandparents' age. So talk about isolation. And nobody in your school gets it, you know. And I had Diana Ross kind of hair, and then half of it fell off. And I told my mom, I ain't going to school if I don't have hair. You're going to have to get me a tutor. This just doesn't work for me. Well, luckily, that big, lovely hair covered the half that didn't, wasn't there. So my experience with cancer was literally a full summer between that sophomore and junior year. And then, fast forward, my dad relapses, and he dies my senior year of high school. And so it was just this whirlwind of culture shift, living between two cultures. You both know this, right? We got one foot in the old world culture, and we've got one foot in this world. And then what am I going to do with my life? I mean, my parents were educators and went all the way, got their PhDs. And so college was without a doubt, you got to go to college. But there's a lot of trauma that you've lived with, whether it was the cancer world or it was, you know, being away. I'm the oldest of 75 cousins just on my dad's side of the family. Mm. And it's funny because after our family started a nonprofit called Libyan Hearts, the year of the Arab Spring in 2011, and when we went back to go do a pilot project, I stood there in a picture with probably 5 of my male cousins who are younger than me. And I'm like the shrimp at 5'5", and they're all, you know, 6 foot. But the story of getting into fundraising, I totally thought after I finished my education at Dickinson College that I'm just going to go be a lawyer or go on to graduate school. Little did I know that taking a year off to work on campus and working in advancement, the power of great mentors, if you all have ever had them, it's like when I was in school and I ended up hating geometry because I had a crappy teacher. But the power of great mentors at my alma mater is what fueled me and what gave me all those skills to then go on and work later in a major consulting company and then take a leap and go and work as a CEO for an NGO. And then ultimately, because of those relationships, Mm-hmm. People came back and said, would you come back and be our consultant for our major gifts campaign or for this new nonprofit that we're trying to start? And so I would just say, like, keep your heart open. You know, my message is, I would have never imagined that girl who was diagnosed at 16 with Hodgkin's disease would have ever, A, moved to Texas, learned about a great organization called Live Strong, and I see a colleague there, Stephanie Moore, in the audience, who finally gave people who've been through cancer a voice, you know, and allowed us to be able to say, wow, I've been through that, and now there's other people who are speaking up and sharing their story, or going on to start my own business, or helping to found a nonprofit or serve on boards. I mean, if little old me could do that, you all bring it. Mm-hmm. Don't be shy and don't hesitate. I think that we have probably time for some questions from the audience, but I have one other question, but you were going to interject.
Yeah, I just want to say, like, every time I speak, because we're all kind of speaking about global issues, I also just want to throw out this idea of cultural context. Mm. And it's very important to keep in mind that, you know, it's, you know, I was talking to Constance earlier, and she was just like, you know, one of the things she says is when you go to a different place, you know, or a foreign country, go as a tourist, you know, just go to enjoy the culture and the people. We don't have to always go thinking that we're going to go save someone or do this or, you know, have a mission or, you know, like, it's just, it's nice to go and enjoy other cultures. And one of the analogies that I have, and it's not exactly the same, but when we think about honor killings in Southeast Asia and different parts of the world, yes, you know, honor killings are extremely terrible. It's one of the things that we fight against. But there's a statistic that more men in the United States have killed their wives or girlfriends than everyone who died in 9/11, all the people who died in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. So it's not exactly an honor killing, but usually they kill their wife or girlfriend because they're jealous or because they didn't want her to do something that she did. So we have to think about all the work we're doing, yes, is working to advance women and girls around the world, but there's work everywhere. These issues...
They transcend.
Range and transcend across all races, all religions, all geographic areas, you know, all economic
levels.
So we just, I really want to say that we need to keep that in mind.
That's a really good point. I appreciate that. Okay, so last question for me is one that is, when I was a CEO at Psychology Beyond Borders, one of the things that became really important to be thinking about is when these folks who are working in ravaged places, whether there was a disaster or a war, you know, you think about whether it's physicians or aid workers or entrepreneurs, there's something called self-care, which we probably all don't do a very good job of as we are voracious about our missions and our passions. But I'm curious if you would share with the group, what advice would you give about having good self-care, and what kind of things do you both maybe do?
I'm just going to say quickly, really quickly, because I want to leave time for a Q&A if anyone has a question. As much as I love Connector, which is a lot in the work that we do, myself and my family are first.
Number one.
Number one, always. And so I just figure out how to balance it.
Great. Mm-hmm. About you, Richie.
Yeah, I would say you have to make that decision, you know, that what's going to take priority. And, you know, occasionally the job would take priority, but for a short period of time. But for the rest of it, you know, you've got to say, you know, family first. I had a hard time saying me first. But I think one of the things that I had to do, especially in the last couple of years before I've transitioned out, was sort of say, okay, I've got 150 things to do, but what is one thing I can do today that would just give me a little bit of joy? Even if it's like, I'm gonna just go get that Toblerone, that's what's going to give me a lot of joy, you know, that's what I would do. Or maybe it was just a walk around the block to look at the fall leaves or something. But just to ask yourself, because if you lose that joy, and there's no more joy in you, it's very hard as a leader then to kind of continue to inspire others. But I'm really interested in hearing what questions.
Okay, questions. Who has a burning question? Yes, sir.
So
Can you actually, I'm sorry, would you mind using the microphone? That way everyone can hear you. And you're so snazzy in your suit. Looking good.
Well, hello, everybody. My name is Jaswant Quintana, and I'm a minority here today.
But you're welcome. You're welcome, minority.
Yeah.
And I had a question as far as, let me introduce myself. I'm a college student at the University of Texas at San Antonio. I'm in the BSMD program there, and I want to be a physician in the future. And one of the organizations that we have at UTSA is a nonprofit called For the Kids. And it's a nonprofit that raises money for kids battling childhood cancer. Mm-hmm. And we don't exactly provide money for treatment, but more family support. Mm-hmm. We give them emotional support and anything that might have changed their life when their kid went through cancer. How can we bring them back on track so that they can live mm-hmm. their life normally? You mentioned that, you know, it's important to have a sense of community. It's important to have a network that you can feed off of so that you can help expand your nonprofit organization. But what can a college nonprofit, a student-led nonprofit, do to expand their organization past just the university, expand through the city, and gain supporters from across Texas?
It's a great question.
Have you guys thought about partnering with other, like, more organizations like Live Strong and, mm-hmm. and you know, other organizations?
There's one called Wonders and Worries also.
Right. So recently we partnered with UT Kids. So UT Health Great. Science Center has the UT Kids program that they run through Methodist Hospital. And they last year formed a partnership with our organization. But, you know, there's still room for improvement. We started with just 5 members. That was our founding organization about 4 years ago before I was ever at UTSA. And now we've grown to have over 40 to 60 members and raised $50,000 last year. So we're looking to grow, inspired by an organization in at University of Pennsylvania called their event's called Thon, and they raise millions of dollars. So what can we do to get to their level or even surpass them, you know?
Yeah, one of the things that I would recommend, and I'm sure you would too, is your nonprofit is a service delivery nonprofit,
yes.
right? And one of the ways to think about it is that the people who are going to be most motivated to give are those that have benefited from your services or their family members, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, kind of start with the inner circle and the next circle out of those, you know, who have benefited, and then really grow from there, you know. So look at, I'll stop there, but, you know, I think one of the basic principles of fundraising is, you know, don't overlook the people who are closest to your organization
mm-hmm.
in the desire to sort of go big, because Thong, that raises millions of dollars, the reason they can do that is because they have a really great list, and they've built that list through years of cultivating people who have benefited or been touched by the organization. So I would think about it in that way. Just start brainstorming and, mm-hmm. and begin reaching out to those folks.
Great. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is there another question? Yes, ma'am. Do you mind going to a microphone? I think this is the only one we've got.
First, thank you so much. This has been such an inspiring session.
Thank you.
I can't tell you how much I just want to stay here and listen to every word. And then I'm, you know, balancing that with the fact that I just want to get out there and do something.
Yeah.
And
That's
make
great.
A change.
That's
so,
great.
Thank you for being so inspiring.
Thank you.
So I'm currently in a corporate environment, and I'm a leader in a corporate environment. I would like to, at some point in my career, transition into a not-for-profit. The session I was at earlier today was about leading and managing across generations. If you can give me some perspective about how do you lead a not-for-profit organization, particularly if you have a corporate background like myself.
Mm, great question.
So I've spent my adult life basically managing a nonprofit organization. Thanks for coming to that other session. A lot of it, I think, for me has been really understanding who I am as a manager and who I want to be as a manager, sort of defining for myself what are my key management principles, you know. So integrity is very important in all things, and my expectations of others, of myself, you know. So, you know, good communication. Bring me problems now. You know, don't let me hear about problems later. So really defining for yourself, I think, what are your core management values and principles, and then taking them and moving them to the nonprofit space because, again, a lot will translate, you know, a lot will work well. And then I think just being open to kind of that dynamic flow of what, you know, what works with one employee and that management relationship doesn't necessarily work with another one, so having some flexibility there. But I do think having a clear sense of your values and your center and your identity as a manager can be very helpful in making that shift so you don't lose yourself mm-hmm. when you make that change.
Awesome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do you want to add something?
Well, I mean, I just think that I really haven't worked in corporate America. I got my degree in economics, and then I was hired by Lady Foot Locker in Chicago. This was like 20, 30 years, whenever. It was a long time ago. And I couldn't stand it, and I lasted there a week, and then I left and went and worked at the Body Shop, which is a hair, you know, the mm-hmm. the care products, because it had more of a social flair, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So, and then ever since then, I mean, I knew that I wanted to do something in this realm, but, you know, didn't know exactly what it was going to be until more recently. So I'm not 100% sure about, you know, your situation right now, but I can just say that just being tenacious and having a drive and not accepting, you know, a failure and rejection. I think when you transition into whatever role you're going to transition into the nonprofit world, I mean, just like having those personality characteristics, those traits are like really extremely helpful.
Excellent. Okay, we're max at time, but before we give a rousing round of applause to our fine panelists here, I just want to give you a couple of touch points. So the keynote at lunch will begin, luncheon will begin at 1 o'clock, so you actually have 30 minutes to go relax, visit, network. Ritu is actually going to be signing her book in the bookstore located in the bookstore in the exhibit halls on number 1 and 2, so look for her if you're interested. And then don't forget to go to the exhibit hall and take advantage of all of the wonderful things that you can shop for in the small business marketplace. Visit the bookstore, the career pavilion, and on. But I just want to thank you all for being so attentive.
Thank you so much.
And I can see from your eye contact that you're really excited about the opportunity, so thank you.
Thank you.